From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this wonderful program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, Changeling, a child substituted for another, and a very strange story of ET presence. Here's what's happening. A class action lawsuit has been filed against Carnival Corporation surrounding those events that crippled the cruise ship Triumph in the Gulf of Mexico. Filing on behalf of other passengers, Matt and Melissa Crizon of Oklahoma, they have alleged in their lawsuit that Carnival knew or should have known that the vessel Triumph was likely to experience mechanical or engine issues because of prior similar issues. The lawsuit alleged that the conditions on the ship created a severe risk of injury, illness, and disease. Richard C. Hoagland was on that ship in December, and of course he reported on Coast to Coast. Astronomers have smashed the record for the smallest planet beyond our solar system, finding one only slightly larger than our own moon. Now, to spot the tiny, probable rocky planet, they first needed to precisely measure the size of its host star, and they did so using what is called astroseismology, effectively turning tiny variations in the star's light into sounds, and they were able to find this. It orbits its star in just 13 days. 2,300 years ago, hordes of mice, snakes, and insects fled the Greek city of Helike on the Gulf of Corinth. After these creatures departed, an earthquake occurred in the night, wrote an ancient Roman writer. The city subsided, and then an immense wave flooded, a tsunami. And Helike simply disappeared. Stan Dale, research physicist, investigates earthquakes. Stan, I've got to ask you, how do you predict them?
Well, George, it's a matter of combining several data streams that I get from various educational institutions that have access to satellite and sea buoy data. And what I do is I look for rapid changes in the anomalous temperatures of the sea. And I combine that with a data set that shows me the electric charge over all the fault line and the variation of it as well. So I take those two data streams, convert them to a graphic, and impress them onto a map of the world so that I can show you not only what the data shows or illustrates there graphically, but what value I put to it as far as an earthquake potential. I circle the area to do that.
And as you look toward the future here, Stan, do you see anything on the horizon?
Well, something is happening in the Southwest Pacific. Over the last 30 days, there have been about 230 or 40 earthquakes that are Richter 5 or better. Now, a lot of those were aftershocks in the Solomons where they had that Richter 8. But there's a lopsidedness on the whole planet to where all these recent, last 30 days, type 5, plus Richter earthquakes have been occurring. The western side of the Pacific is just like having four times as many as the east or eastern side of the Pacific or the western United States, western South America. So something is happening to cause an asymmetric splitting of the planet on the western side of the Ring of Fire.
All right, I have a feeling you're going to be reporting back for Stan's website, standeyo.com. Couples struggling to have a baby should get fertility treatment more quickly, and older women should gain access to in vitro. IVF should be offered after 2 years of failed attempts, not the current three, says the National Institute for Health. And the upper age limit should rise from 39 to 42 for a woman to have a baby, they say. California prisons hire full-time chaplains and spiritual leaders to serve Catholics, Muslims, Jewish people, Protestants, and Native American inmates. And a federal appeals court has given new life to a decades-long battle by Wiccan inmates for access to their own full-time chaplain. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned a trial judge's dismissal of a Wiccan prisoner lawsuit seeking the same rights as the five other religious practices. The appeals court said the Wiccan prisoners make a compelling argument that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation may be unconstitutionally showing preference to the five religions in violation of the First Amendment. Identity theft. It's on the rise again, according to a new industry-sponsored study reversing a promising two-year trend. Some 12.6 million Americans, they say, victimized by ID theft just last year alone, the second highest total since the Federal Trade Commission began counting victims in 2003, and roughly a million more than 2011, according to the survey. The record 13.9 million victims was set in 2009. The criminals made off with $3 billion more in 2011. Overall, slightly more than 1 in 20 consumers were victims last year. Privacy expert Catherine Albrecht with us. Catherine, why so many people victimized by ID theft?
You know, this is the funny part, because they tell us we've got to get rid of cash because it's not secure. And instead, we're supposed to use these numbered accounts that just float around in the ether, and it's no surprise that these things get hacked because they're sitting in giant databases where they're not secure, and that's what criminals sit around and do these days. They don't figure out how to mug you in the parking lot anymore. There's huge bands of these folks over in Eastern Europe who sit around figuring out how to hack into the system and grab your zeros and ones. But the real thing that's got me worried about this, George, is not even the identity theft piece, but the fact that this primes everybody to start demanding better identity for purchases. And you know what that's going to lead to? That's going to lead to biometrics. That's going to lead to an iris scan to buy a gallon of milk. And that's going to lead to the mark of the beast. We know we're going to have a number to buy and sell coming up here in the future. And this is priming the pump to get people ready to not only accept it, but to demand it at the point of a pitchfork and say, yes, we want better controls, tighter identity on purchases. So it's coming.
I bought something today with a credit card, Catherine, $8. And they said, I've got to see your ID.
Yeah. Yeah, it's getting to that point. And what it's going to be in the future, it's not just going to be, I got to see your ID, because you could forge that too. It's going to be, scan your fingerprint, or I want to see the chip in your hand.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's getting crazy.
And without the chip, you cannot buy or sell.
Yeah, well, you know, here we are. Who would have thunk it, huh? You know, when I was a kid, we didn't even have any way to buy or sell with a number. And now that we've actually implemented it, it's not the secure panacea they were telling us. It's really insecure.
Catherine, your website, of course, many of them linked up at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Russell Targ joins us, the reality of ESP, a physicist's proof of psychic abilities. We're going to talk about that and remote viewing for a couple hours here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Russell Targ with us for a couple hours here. Russell, a physicist, pioneer in the development of the laser and other applications, co-founder of the Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities back in the 70s and 80s. Those were the real X-Files, friends. And he now pursues ESP research in California and teaches remote viewing worldwide. Russell, always a pleasure to have you on. How are you, sir?
Fine. I'm very happy to be with you. And we're here tonight to celebrate the great Ingo Swann, who taught us all how to do remote viewing.
I know. He's a dear friend of yours, and we will miss him dearly. He had a fulfilling life, Russell.
I think so. He lived 79 years and painted a lot of beautiful paintings and created a whole industry. Ingo taught us about the idea of remote viewing, and if you go to Google, there's now 2.5 million pages called remote viewing. That's quite an accomplishment.
Toward his last days, Russell, was he still relatively active with remote viewing?
He was not well since really last August.
Ah.
He was not taking care of himself. And I said, let's just say he declined.
He did. I know we tried to get him on the program.
So he lost his will to live.
Yeah, maybe so.
I was very, very sorry about that.
When you two teamed up, when you started putting together the Stanford Research Institute along with Hal Puthoff, when you put that group together, how did you find Ingo? How did that relationship with you come about?
Ingo found Hal. Ingo was with Hal at SRI a few months before I came.
Okay.
And Ingo had been working with Gertrude Schmeidler at the City College of New York. He was able to raise and lower the temperature of thermistors in thermos bottles at a distance, working with Dr. Schmeidler. She's a very, very careful researcher, and I've known her, and I believe whatever she said. very, very competent, conscientious experimental psychologist. And she did experiments with Ingo where she had thermos bottles in a distant room, and she would tell him, raise the temperature of this one, raise the temperature of that one on a random schedule, and he was able to do that.
Amazing.
And he then came to work with Hal in the summer of 1972, and they visited the physics laboratory at Stanford University, where they had a superconducting experiment getting ready for a space program called Gravity Probe B. They were working with, this is a long story, they're sort of working with niobium superconducting balls down in the basement of the Varian Physics Building. And these balls were cooled down to absolute zero, and they had a frequency associated with them as they would turn in the vacuum. So you got these superconducting balls buried away in the vacuum in a chamber under the Civics Building, and you could see that they were alive because they put out a sine wave at their characteristic rotation frequency.
What do you mean alive? Like an organism?
That they were moving, that there was current flowing.
Okay.
No alarm.
Not a little Frankenstein down
there. That's right. These are just like ping pong balls made of niobium metal, spinning in the vacuum, superconducting, and they're spinning driven by the moving magnetic field. That's what kept them spinning. And Ingo's job was to look at this sinusoidal trace, this sine wave, and see, can you move the ball? So it's hidden away, it's shielded, it's superconducting, it's going into space, so it has to be impervious to any outside force. That's the deal. Ingo looked at it psychically. Of course, you can't see it. He was up in the visitor's gallery looking down 30 feet away to something in the basement of the building.
Not knowing what it was.
That's right. He described the whole structure pretty well, but I don't know what he knew in advance. And he said, okay, I got my focus on it. I'm able to hold it. And he slowed down the sine wave frequency by a half that was coming out of the machine. And that was stunning to the people who were putting it into space. It was stunning to the person whose PhD dissertation that was. And the Navy didn't like it much either, who were paying for it. Because the basic premise is that this thing spinning in the vacuum is unperturbable by anything in the world. And then this flamboyant psychic came in when tie-dye T-shirt.
Yeah, with his own mind, and he slows it down.
That's right, and he slowed it down. And people were absolutely stunned. It was an incredible experiment. And I described that whole scene in The Reality of ESP, my new book. In fact, I dedicated the book to Ingo.
Yes, you did.
And he knew that. And I said, for Ingo Swann and all those seeking unobstructed awareness, which is what he was looking for. He often said, it's no longer obstructed. I can see anything in the universe. And the next thing he did is look at a belt of crystals around Jupiter, which is more than a billion miles away. Because what Ingo said is that he doesn't want to waste his time looking at pictures in the next room.
He wanted the big things, huh?
He said, I can focus my attention anywhere in the universe. And I had, Hal and Ingo were together, but they didn't have any dough. My contribution is that I went to a conference where I got to show my ESP teaching machine to Wernher von Braun and
some top scientists, huh?
A number of scientists, including Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And Jim Fletcher, the chief administrator of NASA. And von Braun was very, very good at my ESP game. And that became the first actual sponsored contract we have. I should interrupt my story and say, you can have that ESP game at no charge. You can download it from the Apple Store. From the App Store, called ESP Trainer, and it's a four-choice game that rings the bell and shows you a pretty picture if you get the right answer.
It tunes you up a little bit, doesn't it?
It tunes you up, and people improve their ability.
Russell, when Ingo was practicing this and doing it, he was probably one of the best remote viewers out there.
He was the only remote viewer out
at
there.
At the time, or at least...
He was in a class by himself.
Yeah, at least publicly. I mean,
right.
Some people may have done it quietly and nobody knew what it was. Did he ever go way out into the future? Did he see things that we probably don't even know about?
Well, I don't know about that, but he went way out into space because when NASA came to our lab, they wanted to know, could he view Jupiter when they get there? Because they're sending the Pioneer spacecraft. And he said, yeah, why don't I do a viewing of that? And he and Hal sat down in the neighboring office, and Inga went out to Jupiter. And we now know that when people do remote viewing, they see the thing in real time at the distant location, strongly violating relativity.
Instantly as well, right?
Instantly. And he said that he sees a belt of shiny crystals. As he zooms in, you can see the crystals surrounding the planet. And no one had ever seen that before because they're too faint to see from Earth. But he described them and drew them, and I put his whole transcript in the new book. So this book is, the book really is celebrating Ingo and showing people how to do remote viewing.
And we're going to get into a lot of remote viewing here with you, Russell, in the 2 hours.
Ingo could look at, I mean, Jupiter is more than a billion miles away, and he just had to sit down quietly, light up his cigar, and look out and see something a billion miles away at once, and be the first human being to ever see the crystal surrounding the planet.
Cheaper than a spaceship, let me tell you.
That's right. So Ingo was unique in teaching us how to do remote viewing.
How accurate do you think he was, Russell?
Well, he was very accurate. He did a number of remote viewings. You were talking about looking into the future. When we were under contract to the CIA, they would frequently show up with a task. That is, the deal we made with the devil is that we would spend... Hal and I went to the CIA and made a proposal to them. Because we were accustomed to working with government entities,
sure.
And we had access to the CIA from our previous incarnation. So we got to meet with the head of intelligence at the CIA, John McMahon, and our proposal was, we think we can be helpful to you during the Cold War. We're scientists. We're in favor of intelligence rather than ignorance. We don't want to be involved in killing people. We think you know it should be what's going on. The deal we made with the CIA is that we would spend half our time doing operational things for them, and we promised not to mention their name, and we would spend half the time publishing our findings as we tried to understand the ways and wherefores of psychic ability.
Did they jump at your proposal, Russell?
John McMahon's a very smart guy. People were afraid of him because he doesn't suffer fools. And Hal and I came across as pretty serious characters. We were both known for our laser work. So we didn't walk in with beards and sandals. We looked like the guys he's accustomed to dealing with.
Right.
And
it must have taken him back, seeing you two professional scientists saying what you were saying to him.
That's right. So we said, give us a chance. And he said, okay, I'll give you a demonstration of ability test. So he was a lawyer in addition to a spook. I mean, he went to all over Vietnam laying in the belly of a Lockheed C-130, but he was also trained as an attorney.
That's right.
So he was multi-talented. And he said, I have a place that I need info about. If you can tell me something useful, you're on. And we were on for the next 20 years. And what he had us look at, and this was not an Ingo job, this is a Pat Price job. He had us look at a Soviet weapons factory in far Siberia. And Price was able to describe, lying psychically on top of a building in the sun, as a great crane rolled back and forth over his body, and he drew this giant gantry crane. And then he said, inside the building, they're constructing a 60-foot steel sphere welding it together out of orange peel slices. And that was entirely correct, we found a year later. And no one in the Western world knew anything about it.
Russell, we're coming back with you. We're going to talk more about remote viewing in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Russell Targ with us as we talk about the life of the late Ingo Swann, father of remote viewing and remote viewing in general here. Russell, do you still practice remote viewing? Do you still do this?
I practice it from time to time. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a enthusiastic meditator. And it all began at the about 800 years after Christ. A historical figure, Padmasambhava, brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. Padmasambhava is a documented person. He's written books. Books have been written about him. And he wrote, in particular, he wrote a book a lot like my book, if I might say so. His book is called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness.
Uh-huh.
And as an author, I'm always happy to see that a book is still in print 1,200 years after it was published. And what Padmasambhava says is that if you're suffering, as he looked around, he saw a lot of people are suffering, and he said, the reason you suffer is because you spend a lot of time defending the story of who you are, defending your ego, grabbing the things you see, getting attached to them, and wanting to name them. If you want to be free of suffering, you can quiet your mind and move into timeless awareness. And when I read that, I was really stunned for somebody 1,200 years ago talking about timeless awareness. He said, and then you can see the world as it really is. And what interests me about that is that the instructions that this guru gave 1,200 years ago are exactly the instructions we give people when we're teaching them to do remote viewing. The remote viewing is a non-analytic ability. You can indeed see things in the distance and in the future. You just have to give up your idea to name them and grasp them. So naming is really the enemy of psychic abilities, and that was entirely understood, written down, and published 1,200 years ago. So Buddha, I have a whole section of my book on Buddhist psychic stuff. Buddhists today sort of stand away from ESP, but at the time of Christ and for the next several hundred years, people who were quieting their mind were then encouraged to report seeing into the distance, seeing in the future, healing the sick, diagnosing illnesses, which is all available to us now. But during the so-called Enlightenment, psychic functioning got a bad name.
Why is it?
Oh, it was a fight between the scientists and the church. The scientists thought that the church were that all mysticism was anti-science, and the church indeed was anti-science, and the mystics got swept up with that. Anybody who was wearing a cloak and a hood got swept away with the priests and the wizards and the mystics and the meditators. Didn't happen in India, of course, where there's been a 2,000-year succession of studying consciousness. But the thing that what I teach is basically what's been taught for 2,000
years. 2,000 years, long time.
And it's fun. See, I'm 40 years now into remote viewing, and the reason I'm teaching it is it's very easy to teach. I'm just giving people permission to make use of an ability
they already have.
Yeah. And I set the stage and say, now do that. And I did that with government officials. They would want to see something psychic across the table. And what they wanted me to do is read their dollar bill. And if I did that, they'd think it was a trick. So I would say instead, I've got an interesting object in my pocket, in my briefcase, that I brought just for you. And I would guide them to see that in their mind's eye and describe it and draw it. And then I'd show them my crazy object, and they'd be stunned that they had just drawn the thing that they had never seen before and give us a contract.
How does this work?
I did that many, many times.
I mean, you look without the eyes, basically. How does it work? What do you tap into?
The idea is that there's no separation in consciousness. We live in a modern physics has finally caught up with Buddhism. I should say after the fact, you don't have to be a Buddhist to be psychic. It's just that they studied that and had incorporated it into their ontology 2,000 years ago. But that has nothing to do with people. I don't teach Buddhism if I'm teaching remote viewing, because I'm not proselytizing. You ask me if I do it, and long story is, anybody who sits quietly for a long time will experience some kind of expanded awareness, timeless awareness. That's the payoff for quieting your mind. That is, there are lots and lots of people who sit quietly on a cushion. Nobody ever said they're stupid. It's not really understood why people sit quietly on a cushion. It's because it feels good. You get into spaces that are not normally available.
Russell, let me ask you, when you got together as remote viewers, did you look way into the future in terms of the apocalypse, who the Antichrist could be, or anything like that?
No, okay. No. Ingo did a now famous remote viewing early in the program where the CIA came to our lab and said, we would like you, Ingo, to look 3 days in the future and tell us what's happening at these coordinates. It's Monday now. We want to know what's going to happen at these coordinates, latitude and longitude, on Thursday. And Ingo said, I need my colored pencil. So I went running down from the remote viewing room to the stationery to get his colored pencils. And he then made a beautiful, large drawing of a pyrotechnic display in colors of hemispheres up in the sky, very, very pretty, with a lot of trucks off in the background. And he said, I don't know what this could possibly be, but that's what I see, and it's very pretty, isn't it? And the CIA people knew at the time, but didn't tell us.
Yeah, they knew what was going to happen, right?
They knew that there was a scheduled atomic bomb test in China. And what Ingo drew is an atomic bomb test that was carried out and failed. So he drew a picture of what you get when you burn uranium in the atmosphere. You get a pyrotechnic display, but no mushroom cloud. So he was able to see that 3 days in advance and draw a very accurate picture of what that was.
Did they understand what that picture was when
yes.
he did it, that
yes.
there was
they,
it was a failed test?
They immediately knew that that's a picture of burning uranium.
And that the test did not work.
That's right. So they were, I mean, the CIA continued to support us because we did remarkable things for them. We described the Soviet weapons shop where they rolled the big sphere out. In fact, we had a congressional investigation. Hal and I stood in the well of the House of Representatives, I mentioned to my wife, as we watched President Obama's speech. We stood exactly where he was being grilled by the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. They were sure there was a security leak. Price had died by then, and they couldn't understand how we could have the information. They were upset that somehow California psychics knew about this particle accelerator to shoot down spacecraft. We knew about it and told the CIA 2 years before anyone else in the Western world. And there were Christian fundamentalists in Congress who felt that if we're not doing this work through Jesus, it must be through the devil. So nothing's changed.
Did the CIA...
But we were exonerated. All of our supporters from Defense Intelligence Agency and CIA and Army Intelligence all said it's real. They've been doing this for years. And we then went off to the White House for dinner.
Russell, did the CIA ever get back to you and say these were great hits? I mean,
yes.
Did they tell Ingo?
Yes, we got feedback as we went along. That's how I'm able to tell you. And I've published all that. I have now had this declassified. So my new book for the first time I can tell you all of this stuff and none of us have to go to jail. So the reality of ESP is my last book on psychic stuff. I call it A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. And the reason I'm willing to say that we've proved it is we now have many, many formal experiments at odds of a million to one that are more significant than, for example, the National Institutes of Health tested aspirin to prevent heart attacks, as you know. And everybody is now taking aspirin. And the statistical significance of ESP in our lab is 10 times greater than the NIH significance for aspirin. So given the data of ESP that we have now, the reality of ESP is so strong, it would be statistically unreasonable to deny it. So I'm willing as a physicist to say, we've proved this. Proof is no longer the issue. It'd be nice to have a better model for how it works, but the non-locality of space and time will answer that as well. This modern physics is catching on to how it works, because what we see is that we misunderstand the space and the time where we live. For elementary particles, there's no separation. They're entangled with one another. Just as our consciousness is not really separated from distant things. What in the experiments we've done where Ingo describes Jupiter or Gary Langford describes eclipses of the moon of Jupiter, they're like 40 light minutes away, and both of these people were able to see them in real time. So the whole idea of distance and separation is ill-conceived, that our consciousness and our ability to experience the world is non-local. What that means is that if I tell you I've got an interesting object here and want you to describe it, you don't have to come to my house to look at that. You don't have to find my desk. There's already no separation. If you're interested, it's like if I ask you, can you remember your phone number? And you say, of course I can. You write it down. I say, well, where did you go to find that? And you don't actually know where you went to find your phone number. It's just available. Similarly, you can describe anything in the universe that has an answer. And people who work with psychics, the first person that said that was an Icelander when I was in Iceland a number of years ago, who's working with Frances Farrelly, very experienced Southern psychic lady, was helping them place their thermal wells in Iceland. And she said, I can help you do anything. If you have a question that has an answer, just ask me and I'll give you the answer.
Ingo once wrote a book called Penetration, and he talked about things on the far side of the moon, structures on the moon. You and I talked a little bit about that last year, Russell, where, you know, you said, if I can paraphrase you, Ingo was a great writer. And, you know, some of this could have been fiction. What do you think still?
I don't, it's unknown. Ingo is also a science fiction writer.
That's right.
So he wrote that with great verisimilitude. Could be true. If you told me, don't equivocate, what do I think? I think it's science fiction. It's hard to believe. It's very stretched. It's one of these things. I know that ESP exists. I'm willing to bet any amount of money on that. With the penetration thing, I think it's very unlikely that there's another civilization on the moon. I think my opinion is Ingo's pulling our leg. I could be wrong, but that's what I think.
Did he talk much about it?
Not to me, because, I'm sort of a data junkie. That is, I've had UFO experiences also, but it's very hard to tell whether I'm making them up or whether they were really there. There's people have all kinds of experiences. They have near-death experiences. They have abduction experiences. And I'm sort of an unreconstructed logical positivist, if you could excuse me. I mean, I'm trained as a physicist. I can't help myself. That I will listen to anybody's crazy story, and if there's some way of verifying it or falsifying it, I'm all in. Tell me more. But if he's telling me about the message he got from God, well, I'm happy that makes him feel better. But since there's no way for me to tell whether it's true or not true, I believe he had an experience. I'm ready to move on and try and just figure out something else.
Russell, do you find that more people are tapping into remote viewing than they were?
Yes, a lot of it. I could spend my whole life running around the world teaching remote viewing. I was just invited. Like every 6 months, I tell my wife, I'm really done doing this now because it's a lot of wear and tear. Traveling's not as fun as it used to be. And then I get an invitation. How would I like to go to Sardinia for a week? Or how would I like to go back to Iceland? So I really, if somebody makes me a good offer, takes me to some exotic place I haven't been before, I'm still up for it.
Yeah.
And there continues, it's like people want to catch me before I die. So in the last couple of years, I've had more requests to go to interesting places to teach than I've had before, and I'm willing to do that.
Are you still motorcycling?
No, I surrendered the motorcycle.
Finally. My gosh, how long were you doing that?
I rode 35 years without getting killed.
And if I'm correct, your vision is pretty darn impaired, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a legally blind motorcyclist. In fact, I wrote a book called Memoirs of a Blind Biker.
Thank God for remote viewing, huh?
That's right. But the traffic, I live in Silicon Valley, and things are hopping here. There's more traffic, and everybody's in a big hurry. And I did have an accident. Somebody simply ran through a stop sign into me.
Oh.
And I decided that's enough of that.
Yeah.
I survived that. I'm uninjured. But I decided the walking is good for me.
It's a dangerous exercise, isn't it?
Yes.
In
Reality of EST, it's really an homage to Ingo. I publish a lot of stuff from his work that's never been published before. And I give examples of why I'm convinced we've proved psychic ability. The two things that really prove it to me, my two favorite, my all-stars, is Pat Price finding the kidnapped car that where Patricia Hearst, the heiress, was kidnapped.
Sure, I remember that story, yeah.
And stolen away by the SLA. I stood with Price at the police station where he told the detectives, it's about 50 miles north, parked by a diner across from two white cylinders near a pedestrian overpass. One of the detectives recognized that on his way to Vallejo, where he lived, and within 20 minutes, they had the car.
Some psychics and remote viewers who tell the police things that nobody else knows, do they sometimes get looked at as if they're the suspect?
They sure do. You know, we had that happen with a local woman, Catherine Ray, helped the police find a body that was in a cave in northern Oregon State, and it was so buried, and she was so successful that she got arrested.
Ugh.
And the local police, the people who knew her in San Jose, had to bail her out.
Russell, we're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with you. Plus, I want to talk about the book, The Reality of ESP. When we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.